This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 47 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as he always is Mike Morrison. Mike, today we have a very special episode. It's episode 47, and that can only mean one thing.
Only one thing. I can think of 47 reasons why I'm excited about today's special guest.
Well, today we've got a special guest. We've got friend of the network, Dr. Trek himself, Larry Nemechek.
Transporter Chief, energize.
Larry, welcome to the show.
Wait, did I hear you say this was show 47?
It is.
And you didn't skip it because you know how unlucky 47. Oh wait, that's 13. Yeah. Yeah. Wait. No, guys, this is amazing, and I think it's so awesome that you know Metatrex of all the shows is a special. Well, I think some of them have had special 47 shows, but no, it's fun to be here, and thanks for asking me.
Well, we've been wanting to have you on for a long time. You know, Star Trek is dear to our hearts. You know more about the insides of Star Trek than anyone I know, and I'm thrilled to have your perspective on just the way things have changed in Star Trek. You know, it's an interesting time in Star Trek fandom. Star Trek's been around for 50 years. We have a new Star Trek TV show coming. You know, we've got you know, new challenges in this world in the modern era. And I'm just anxious to get your perspective on how the world has changed and how Star Trek can continue to play the best role it can in the modern world.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's a 5-minute topic. you know, if we stretch,
we'll be here all day.
Yeah. No, it really is an interesting time. I mean, these last 10, 12 years are finally over. I call the fallow times or the fallow era. Like wandering in the wilderness here, not to get all biblical, but and we're out of it, and it's almost like it took a few years of people having no Trek to kind of realize what they didn't have, you know, and people all of a sudden started loving Enterprise, including those who like watched one show and never saw any more, or even Voyager for that matter, but or even DS9 for that matter, but you know, it was a time to re-examine, and you get to take a breath, and it's almost like We've had a double crossroads here of celebrating the 50th, which was fun and easy to do and kind of fits our nature of, you know, there's that saying about everybody always starts fighting the next war the way they did the last one. And it's always disastrous. Mm-hmm. Machine gun, what's that? Tank, what's that? And it's a little bit the same way with the new Star Trek incarnation. Every time there's been a new wave of Star Trek, people go at it like they enjoyed or the way they remember the last one. And they even bring their critiques to the new one, which sometimes is kind of a non sequitur. And it's like, no, things have changed. You know, technology's changed, TV production's changed, the world has changed, and our natural outlook has changed. It's like, here, I get to actually use my theater background. It's like in the Middle Ages, when they tried to go back and hearken back to the Greeks in Europe, I think the Italians, and they couldn't help but they were going to build everything the way the Greeks and Romans did, the Greeks did. And they wound up just not even thinking about it, adding a proscenium, you know, to it. And totally not doing exactly what the Greeks did, but it was their own worldview. They couldn't help but bring their own time to it. And that's what happens with Star Trek every time. But it takes a while for that to sink in. And so out here in a vacuum, we've had 10, 12 years of people arguing, debating, wishing what the new Star Trek would be. And now it's here, and people don't know what to make of it sometimes. And I think people get trapped into looking at everything through the old filters, not knowing what the new even can be, you know, much less how. And then the whole thing of social media and you know, we've never had a live weekly Star Trek with social media going. So, I mean, it's been a transition time, and some of the things that are going to be different, some of the things to explore in my documentary, The Con of Wrath, yes, it's really going to happen, is what's the same and what's different. You know, that's looking at a 30-year perspective, the 80s fandom and today's fandom, both technology, or culture and Star Trek both. So, yeah, I look forward to see where you meta guys are going to take this, because it's just been the last year or two that some of these things have kind of bubbled up, and you go, well, because I see people do things online, and again, remembering that the online fandom, my other soapbox, that's just like 1/10 of 100% of fandom, but we get used to it. It's like looking at fandom through what you see at, say, Vegas. That's the slice of fandom that has the money and the will to get there. It's not all fandom. And anyway, things to think about. So yeah, I'll shut up and let's dive in.
It's interesting you mentioned the social media aspect, because for me, watching things unfold as we followed the news stories leading up to Discovery, which I'm excited about, it almost, in some ways, I'm having a little deja vu in that it's kind of this old pattern of, hey, we're going to have a new Star Trek series and, you know, gripe, 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 fuss, fuss, fuss. But it's like 10 times worse because of the social media aspect. So in some ways, it almost seems like there's more negativity among fans. But I don't think that's the case, because we saw it. We saw it with Enterprise, certainly. We saw it before that with Voyager and Deep Space Nine before that. And it goes all the way back to
Next Generation. Oh, yeah. One of the biggest. Next Generation and Wrath of Khan. And, of course, that was kind of shocking. Oh, Spock's dead. We weren't, you know, the marketing boycott. Not just the marketing boycott, but the people that went out and paid for marketing study and took out, you know, that was a world where you took out full-page ads in the New York Times or Variety or something to say, we've done a marketing study, and if you kill off Spock in this movie, you will lose, you know, 42%, 47% of your box office and your ancillary revenue from, you know, toys and action figures and magazines and books. And, you know, that's what that was like. But, yeah, you're right. That social media has magnified what's always been there. But in the old days, you had to go to a convention and hear the rumor and get pissed off. And or, mm-hmm. like in letters in Starlog, which would be like bi-monthly or whatever, and then monthly. Or if you were really up on it, your letters in Interstat, which was the little letter of comment zine, mm-hmm. which is kind of like having a monthly comment thread.
Yeah,
you know, it was like long letters. Mm-hmm. So I was like, imagine a 90s message thread, a message board, or a really long thing, you know, I don't know, Tumblr posts, 30 in a row or something, or 30 really long Facebook thread messages once a month typed. But that, you know, that's where, you know, so it would still be there, but you had to be in that little rarefied world. And then the people, again, with the means and opportunity and motive, mm-hmm. to do that. And yeah, everything is just so magnified and so accelerated with social media, but then we're used to living the rest of the world that way, so it's no big deal. But I always say it's like this is what I just said is wrong. I always want to say it's 5-10% of fandom. It's not even that much, but it's that loud. I would just say the loud 10%, much like politics.
Yeah, well, it surprises me how much, it's bloggers, it's these kind of fake news sources. I recently, when Brian Fuller announced that he was stepping back on Discovery. Right. I mean, the stories that were coming out is people were just pontificating at great lengths on Brian Fuller stepping back with very little information and just elaborating to the nth degree.
Can I just say, I just had a, okay, that's the other thing. So that's the, there's a piece of me that's saying, let's hurry up and get this. I mean, there's a piece of me that just says, can we just please get the damn thing debuted so we can just settle into the curve? It's the same way with any of the movies, although they've just been one-shot efforts. But a series will be awesome because we'll finally be in week to week, even if it is only 13 weeks, and then wait.
But Larry, I guess the question I've got, Larry, is that – you're kind of describing this fan angst. Like, there's some anxiety built up about this. We're in this 10 or 12 year drought of Star Trek not being on television. We've got the 50th anniversary. Star Trek means something to all of us. So there's some need that Star Trek fills that is not being met. You know, I think that the J.J. Abrams movies didn't necessarily fill the need. Right. You know, people had problems with Enterprise.
Leonard Nimoy showed that this is not, you know, if it was anything, it was, I remember the first few moments of Leonard being dead and I saw people saying, well, I wonder if the mainstream media is going to cover this. And I was thinking, you know, I think, look around, I think we are the, what Pogo said, we are the media, and we have met the enemy and he is us. You know, it's like, we are the mainstream media. The geeks won. Did you not get the memo? You know? It's like it sneaked up on people. And same thing on that angle too. What I was going to say a second ago was this whole thing about the world melting. I mean, I was disappointed too, but I was glad to see, you know, Brian very quickly saying, well, look, it is, I knew that there were three or four or five scripts in. They've apparently cast the show with the lead if they haven't done that by now. It's not like his format, his structure, his story idea, if they back away from it, it's going to be, it'll take, there's momentum now set, you know, set up. They're not going to delay again to throw it out and start an entirely new show. And then he says he's going to be on all the story breaks, you know, helping set the tone. So it was disappointing, but there is that. But the main thing was like, where are you people who are like now dreading the fact that he's gone 9 months ago, where you're going, oh my God, you know, Brian Fuller. Oh, it's like, wait, 10 months ago, half the world was like moaning about the fact of who is this guy, or he's hooked up with, you know, Alex Kurtzman, and that's going to, I just the internet's just, yeah, the angst. It's like ping pong angst. It's like, guys, either it's one way or it's another. Either you hated to see Brian, which I thought was ridiculous, or, you know, anyway, you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. You know, in my mind, you know, it's the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, and it's a good chance to kind of pause and just ask, what does all of this mean? What role does Star Trek play? What role has it played in the last 50 years? Of course, you know, you can look back at the situation in the 60s and into the 70s and into the 80s, and we've covered that ground a lot, but, you know, the world has changed. So what does Star Trek mean to us today? How, you know, what does it mean to us as an individual? What does it mean for the types of ideas that can be covered, whether political ideas or social ideas or abstract philosophical ideas, and how can Star Trek, continue to play a role? Like, what is the problem in the world today that Star Trek should be trying to solve? And I think in the 60s, you could say there were genuine problems in the world, racism and whatnot, and Star Trek played a role in changing people's attitudes. You know, not it didn't change it in its own, of course. I mean, it was one factor amongst many, but Star Trek played a role, I think, in changing people's mindsets. And so in this day and age, given all the changes we've seen in the world since Star Trek has been on television, how can Star Trek continue to play the most active role in helping to change people's perceptions and moving the world forward in a way? I think Star Trek can play an act, not just being a form of entertainment, but actually playing a role in moving the world forward.
Well, I mean, you go back, you know, why did Star Trek originally catch on in the beginning? Well, you said 60s is racism. Also, the ecology movement started, well, it really started in 69, which is a bit after this, which is why there wasn't a token green, you know, episode.
Green episode.
But it's woven, it's in the DNA. But, you know, Vietnam and the nuclear, and the nuke race, and the worry about, you know, destroying yourselves, and things like, you know, overpopulation, you know, the Mark of Gideon, a lot of those themes, but, you know, everything that can spring from it, from infinite diversity, infinite combination, and Gene's basic premise about we won't kill each other, we won't kill the world, we will survive, and we will go out and we will live long and prosper. We will go out and thrive and meet others and then hopefully not kill them and then not kill us and have, you know, understanding on a galactic scale, much less a global scale. But the metaphor was definitely for Earth and for humanity. And at the time, civil rights, worrying about the bomb, was a big thing. And I think, I don't know if so much people enjoyed the messages as they just enjoyed the hope. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you're talking about 66, 67, 68. Vietnam was rapidly going downhill. You had the, you know, 68 was the year of the assassinations, you know, Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. And you know, we're finally getting away from this, but 1968 was such a branded, you know, the media loves to do, you know, on the anniversary of 68, the year of change and all that. Because I don't know that we've had, you know, the Chicago riots, Democratic Convention. And that was a pivotal year. And it was all, so, you know, the boomers caught up with that. And it's talking about today, there are some things that are coming full circle. I mean, I remember thinking in the 90s, Next Gen going into Voyager and DS9 and the ratings going down, in part because they were splitting the audience, and thinking that the 90s were so, in a way, getting cushy. I wish we had blogging back then or whatever. I don't know if this ever came to fact. I've thought about it in time since. About that maybe Star Trek, you know, the 60s and Gene's original series and protests and marching and civil rights and Vietnam, anti-Vietnam and all that was such a raw, visceral, improve the world, let's save the world before we can improve it, kind of raw, you know, cutting edge, bleeding edge time. And the 90s, you know, through the 80s seemed such a spin from that. And then, you know, the Reagan 80s. And then the 90s were so cushy for most of the decade. And almost wondering if Star Trek had outlived its, if it was going to be a sentimental, emotional, you know, generational thing. And then on top of that, the computer age coming in, the digital age coming in, people not needing to go to, well, everybody just sit at home and get their fandom? Will conventions die out? And that was kind of the trend and the angst at the time. And then, oh, don't worry, we'll have 9/11 and a major, the second coming of the Great Depression almost. And social media. And it's like the last 10 years have kind of said, you know, well, the bad news is, no, we're all still humans and crap is still going to happen. And the good news is, out of that, the silver lining is that Star Trek is still relevant, can be relevant, has a message, you know, the Gene, the Roddenberry vision, but also it's back to giving people hope, whether they're actually, consciously thinking about, oh, I enjoyed that show and its theme of anti-drug, you know, the Just Say No Nancy Reagan show on Nick, or whatever it is, or the, oh, Critical Care on Voyager speaking to the healthcare crisis, the on-the-nose stuff. And some things were more Twilight Zone-ishly artfully done in the 60s because that's the way they wrote TV then, and it's harder to do that now. But it seems like, you know, be careful what you wish for, Lieutenant, you'll get it. It seems like Star Trek is relevant and or giving hope to people again because of the times. I mean, there's a piece of me that would love to have the cushy 90s again, but then, you know, we've made social progress too just in the last 5-10 years. So I'm not wanting to get in a time machine and go back to past time, but it's for good and bad. It seems like Star Trek has found its niche again. And, you know, I'm a big Will Rogers fan, and for years and years people would say, well, I wonder what Will Rogers would say about today. Like it was his birthday Friday. It was one of those times, well, I wonder what Will would say about this year's election and the times we're in right now. And we're about, it's exciting because we're about to see what a Star Trek with an hopefully imaginative, you know, showrunner and his staff can do, because we're in a perfect time to have Star Trek. It's ripe. It's ripe for Star Trek. So all those old fears about, oh, gee, have we outgrown Star Trek's ability to deliver hope through reminding us what the future can be, what we can still get to, because we've come 20, 30, 50 years, but we're still a hell of a lot, you know, a long way away from Federation ideals and, you know, whether we've got, you know, dangerous admirals still running around or not.
Well, I think you're onto something.
Admirals.
It seems like the world today is structurally similar in some ways to the world of the late 1960s. You know, we have issues with racism and civil rights, you know, Islamophobia and whatnot. We're coming out of turbulent, violent times. Everyone's concerned about terrorism. We're coming out of a bad economy. And frankly, a great many people that I talk to, people I know really well, and I feel like they should kind of know better than to approach life in this way, have adopted this kind of fatalistic attitude. They don't have a lot of hope. They've just been accepting whatever life has dealt them, and they're not willing to kind of push forward and make the world a better place. And Star Trek can be that kind of guiding light that pushes you forward, you know, get you out of bed every day, but, you know, think about how the world could be, not just how it is, and accepting all of the terrible things that we see around us and just driving the world forward. And it takes people to rise to the occasion to do that. I think Star Trek can be that, you know, emotional force that gives you a vision.
There'll always be people that, people who are ripe for Star Trek who aren't fans, who you think, oh, you will love this. And over the years, like in the 20 years, when we got into the 80s and 90s, we already had the way of, I can't watch that show, that old 60s show with, you know, the texture, the visualness of it, the surface of Star Trek put people off. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's Christmas lights on plywood sets and cheesy special effects. I can't wait. And they wouldn't have, especially if they were younger, maybe. And it's like, it's It's like you either get, it's like learning language. You either get in when you're little and your parents raise you with Trek, or you somehow stumble upon it, or you have to go through your teenage years being, oh, this is ridiculous and I can't be a nerd and watch it. And then somewhere in your 20s and 30s and life beats you up a little bit or wears you down a little bit and you're paying bills and raising, and you go, oh, and you can get past that, the era of the original creation. And for so long, Next Generation, you know, was the shiny new thing. And he used to talk about how the pendulum swung, you know, when for 20 years, the original series was what kept Star Trek alive. It's what it was there. And even 20 years later, it was so shockingly speaking to people. And then when Next Gen was at its height, like you know, the early 90s, and the foam was that direction in the Berman era, and there really was, oh, that's when it really started coming out. Oh, the 60s are so, you know, so retro. I mean, you know, the 60s look, you know, the sets, yeah, the effects and all that. And I was kind of shocked. It's like, what? This is classic Star Trek. You wouldn't be enjoying Next Generation if it wasn't for this. Don't you get the roots? Don't you get the DNA? That's just the surface. So, you know I grew up with that, the 20 years of us knowing 79 shows. But come on, what? How can you enjoy the new? But there was that. And then what's hysterical was within 5 or 6 years when the burnout on Next Gen and the split audience happened, and then we get to, you know, as the numbers are dwindling and Enterprise is out there, and then all of a sudden the 60s are retro cool again. And when they're going to rebirth the franchise, well, of course we go back and reboot the original series with the first movies. And it's like, okay, people, okay. Again, it's like everything is a pendulum swing. And it's like some people are smart and just, you know, marketers, I guess, know that. You know, there's the nostalgia 20-year cycle that everything is cool when it's 20 years later, you know, and not that Star Trek is only nostalgic, heaven forbid, but it's somewhere between, and we talk about millennials now, the most we've ever talked about since the boomers first came in the what, before we worried about having labels for generations, and the greatest generation, although we didn't call them that then, we needed, what's his name's book to come out, Brokaw's book, I guess. Yeah. But it's like we didn't used to, it's like everything else. Star Trek did all these things in the entertainment world that now we say, oh, cinematic universe and, oh, multiplayer world. Well, Star Trek was doing the damn thing before there were labels. And Star Trek fandom was inventing the internet with paper and postage stamps. You know what I'm saying? And even the things that we culturally talk about the Star Trek audience had been there for ages. We just didn't have labels back then. And now we do. But so we talk about generations. And it's like I'll go to cons, and again, not that that's a perfect microcosm, but I get into stereotypes too. And if I see a younger fan, I just assume that they came in through the JJ movies. And every once in a while, you have people that prove, you know, exception proves the rule, or it's texture. And I remember having two stick out in my mind. One time at Phoenix Comic Con, and we're doing the panel on State of the Trek where we talk about some of these themes, hopefully. And I try to get people to think, you know, not so much think outside the box a little bit, but connect dots that have been there and maybe they haven't put them together. And somebody raised their hand and said, yes, I have been a fan since the JJ movies. And yes, I used to call it the big evil CBS Paramount plot to see a movie and then go back and find, you know, Netflix or the box sets or whatever. And he said, yes, I've done that. I've watched every other episode and I can now tell you that the JJ movies are crap. But that's what he came in with, you know. And another time I was talking to a young girl, she was like 20 or something. And I said, so the JJ fan, huh? And she got really adamant and not, you know, not feisty. But she was like, no, I did not. I have friends who have been on my ass for, you know, 10 years that I should be watching this and doing this. And I'm like, eh. And I finally gave it a try. And oh, my God. And I forget whether it was original or Next Gen or whatever it was, you know. But she totally just succumbed to the originals and maybe, you know, Blu-ray era and remasters and all that. And all that did help get people over the hump of accepting a 60s show, mm-hmm, and watching it, you know. And what's amazing, I mentioned the pendulum swing back to retro cool. And then people, you know, people made fun of the Next Gen. You know, oh, carpeting on the walls. Ooh, a therapist on the bridge. It's so 80s. And I was like, guys, those were intentional choices. It's like, you know, I would say, you'd hear that, and I'd say, and what's the suicide rate for returning, you know, Iraqi, Afghanistan vets? What, you know, are we still making fun of mental health? Yeah, I mean, maybe they didn't write her the best, especially at the beginning, but the idea of having a therapist, you know, a counselor for the crew, what, one for 1,100 people? That's a good ratio, much less right there in the command center. So, you know, those, but again, some of these things are style and generational driven, but in the long haul, when things kind of leaven out, you know, it blends together. And in the last 10 years, that's all we could do is be introspective and look backwards. And it's almost like the JJ movies have found their own niche. I mean, I enjoyed Beyond better than the other two, but you know, I was disappointed in the format because I want to keep exploring, you know, Cannon Boy here wants to explore crime because there are so many holes left. But I'm glad to see, I was smart enough to see, A, they were well cast, but B, how many new fans have come in because of that. It has kept Star Trek in the mainstream. For people who only are on a shallow level, it's made Star Trek relevant and modern and not continuing just to be dusty old 80s, 90s, 60s relics. But so yeah, that's all been in the mix. And so I'm excited to see people who exist only on a shallow level of the now have Star Trek be able to bust through that. I was saying the last couple of years, even with all that Star Trek has done with the JJ movies, with the Kelvin timeline, excuse me, and the KLT or whatever, KTL, and not to be confused with FTL, the KTL movies, and just the talk of this, what I'll call the Comic-Con factor, even saying what I said before. When will Star Trek break through, for better or for worse, and be the hot little thing that all the 15-year-olds are cosplaying? You know, I thought maybe we'd see more Jaylas than, you know, like Rey. How you saw the Rey breakout? I kept expecting to see something like that, at least on a shallow, you know, obvious barometer like cosplaying, and I didn't. And in Star Trek, even with the 50th, it's the biggest footprint it's ever had this year. And I'm sorry, guys, I'm throwing out a ton of stuff here, but even with the 50th and as big a footprint as they've ever had at, say, Comic-Con San Diego, and something we can talk about later on is some of this balderdash about blowing the chance to celebrate the 50th, which I go, are you kidding me? But even with that, I was, I hate to say disappointed, to see not as much Star Trek at mainstream Comic-Cons, you know, multi-genre Comic-Cons as, because I thought if there'd ever been a breakthrough year, breakout year for Trek in that realm, that this would be it. And so I'm really hoping, another reason why it was disappointing to move back to May, because that window of buildup will not be there so much for the summer cons. But I was excited to see what Brian was going to do in a breakout way to punch through some of this level of, does it really take people 5, 10, 15 years to find Trek who weren't born, you know, raised with it? Because it's out there and it's going to appeal to people. But, you know, anyway, that, and again, that's just a barometer. But I was curious to see that. The 51st year of Star Trek may be its big breakout.
I think we have Hulu.
Did I throw enough stuff out there to keep you guys?
I got a couple things.
Yeah, I think we have Hulu and Netflix and streaming services to thank for this. But it seems that there is an upswing in interest in older TV shows, like, you know, Bonanza, I Love Lucy, Andy Griffith. It just seems like more and more people.
Perry Mason.
Yeah, people are finding these shows and. You know, talking about Discovery, I know there are folks out there who think I've probably been a little insular about it because I've not commented much. I see a lot of fans talking about, you know, I want to see Fuller push the envelope, and you know, we need to take this thing, and we need to take on these social issues, and we need to push this, and we need to push that, and certainly he's in interviews he's given some indications that he wants to do that, but I got to be honest, for lack of sounding a little bit like the Statler brothers, whatever happened to Randolph Scott,
Riding the trail alone.
I knew you'd get that.
I knew. I'm with you. No, I love the Statler brothers.
I just hope that the new series will call back a little bit, because I think the pendulum has swung, and Zachary hit the nail on the head. We're living in times that are very much similar to the 1960s, and I think what helps Star Trek really plant its flag in pop culture is the fact that in a time when the Cold War was going on and there was a lot of fear and you know there was chaos in society,
anxiety
certainly, Star Trek comes along and offers us this this utopian view of the future in which, you know, humanity has evolved and we've gotten past war and we've gotten past poverty and we've gotten past these things. We've gotten past the social stigmas. So, you know, I'm really hoping that Star Trek doesn't, you know, kind of go the route of dystopian fiction, but rather I hope it'll call back a little bit to that wagon train to the stars, the kind of, you know, exceptional human values that I think Star Trek has always portrayed.
I like the way both of you are framing this because, Larry, you asked an interesting question, Larry. What does it take for Star Trek to appeal to the next generation, you know, to get those 15-year-old fans excited about, mm-hmm. about Star Trek? And way back in our, I'm thinking way back to our first episode of Metatrex, you know,
we're going to go in the Wayback Machine.
Wayback Machine to a year ago, our first episode of Metatrex.
Call me Mr. Peabody!
We made a distinction between, this is a podcast on Star Trek and philosophy, and we kind of made a distinction. You know, there's the philosophy of Star Trek. There's the Gene Roddenberry worldview, the right. things people associate with the ethos of Star Trek. Then there's philosophy in Star Trek, the particular ethical dilemmas and particular issues that are raised inside episodes. And then there's all the abstract ideas that are kind of inspired by Star Trek. But in my mind, it's kind of a question of values. Star Trek, there's things, with every generation, there's going to be things that...
I would think there's also going to be a level of fandom. Now that you're framing it that way, the psychology of the fandom, you know, success and reaction and some of the things I was talking about, but I'm sorry, go ahead.
You know, absolutely. Yeah. I think with every new generation, the world is changed. Each generation has its own challenges, its right. own worldview. The political situation has changed, whatnot. I mean, you even mentioned something interesting, like Counselor Troi being on the bridge in at the beginning of The Next Generation. That was a novel idea because we had this new sort of self-help pop psychology approach right. in the 1980s, and that was new, and that got incorporated into Star Trek. So there's a lot of stuff that's going to change every generation. But I'm really interested in the things that are sort of transgenerational or more universal. Mm-hmm. What in human nature, whether it's our values, whether it's our aspirations, our hopes, our innate human nature, what does Star Trek speak to at that universal transgenerational level that will keep it appealing regardless of all the the newfangled whatever they put inside the new Star Trek show?
Well, universal themes. Well, and that's okay. So it's the Roddenberry vision. It's that we, you know, the most revolutionary thing, and a lot of people forget about IDIC, Infinite Diversity and Recombination. And it's kind of funny because, you know, you go back and you say, well, that started as maybe it was the subtext that was between the lines, but to be personified and attributed to the Vulcans, you know, and we're talking about a third season show, you know, is there in truth no beauty? And B, they had that minor little kerfuffle, you know, Nimoy apparently didn't want to do this because they thought it was just Gene and Majel coming up with a pendant they could sell before Roddenberry.com, it was Langdon Enterprises. At the very beginning, it was, his production company is called Norway. Anyway, they were just going, oh, Gene, Jesus Christ, the show's going to go off and you're just sticking a pin out there you can sell. You know, I mean, there was even a kind of a crass reaction, even a little mini revolution there on stage. And but, you know, he did wear it. And now we think, oh, my God, this is one of the most hallowed concepts of Star Trek. And it personifies, it encapsulates everything Star Trek is about. So with that little backstory and even laughing about that, that is kind of the core of Star Trek and what, and you know, it's like for since day one, and I can remember this happening in the 80s, and my joke line when you get a little fandom fight, you know, back and forth about something, and I would just go, Idic, 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 you know, like, hey, believer, you're supposed to believe this. But what people maybe put overlook sometimes, and Gene would say this, is that Idic is not just about toleration. It's celebration of diversity and realizing that if we were all just pressed out of the same mold, you know, that would be very boring. And that's supposedly, as and Enterprise got back to this a little bit, what was supposed to be so special about humanity was that we weren't all blue-skinned and white-haired. We weren't all just pointy-eared. I mean, they even, you know, introduced black Vulcans after a while and, you know, and the albino Anar Andorian. I mean, it's like the longer we got to, you know, and differentiated foreheads for Klingon families. I mean, it's like diversity even started to seep into some of our, you know, our stereotypical Star Trek alien cultures even. But damn, I've lost my thread here. I'm trying to say that, sorry, I was trying to say something about diversity. About tolerating versus celebrating diversity. And it's not just a thing to go, okay, I'll put up with you. Okay, I'll let you stand on the corner and scream at me. But it was like digging deeper. And maybe we don't always get that at first. And you know, you still have to have a dramatic story. That's the inherent, you know, that's what drove everybody crazy on Next Generation when Gene got into his philosopher stage. And, you know, because Scotty and McCoy and Kirk would like bash heads all the time, you know. And, oh, we can't do that on Next Generation. And it took forever for them to get the handle on how to do your dramatic conflict, not to snooze the audience. You want an audience who enjoys a story. Mm-hmm. And the other still has to be subtext. And that became the great challenge of Next Generation. And then they got pretty good at it. They almost specialized, the writers and everybody almost specialized themselves out of going off and having a job elsewhere. Until Ron and Brannon and Renee and Brian and Rob and, you know, all the Narain, till the boys brought that kind of revolution in storytelling, you know, bits and pieces of it to what they could do elsewhere. But yeah, that's kind of that whole thing of you know, and Gene himself would say, we can't just do, oh, what's your story pitch? Well, it has a story about a planet where the people blah, you know, fill in the blank. It's still got to be about the characters. It's still got to be a dramatic story to function and start. And the Roddenberry vision still has to be the subtext, but it's also, we haven't talked about technology and how people have gotten to embrace technology. And do we worry about M5 and Tau or Skyrim, or do we embrace it and master it and make, you know, and that's something else that Star Trek did was, look, guys, don't freak out about technology. We won't kill ourselves with the bomb on that level. Or you know, kill the planet off with whatever microbes or chemicals that we actually, you know, we harness that and still make it our we're still the master of it. And anyway, but that dynamic between the underlying thing is so simple of what appeals to people. It's respect and it's toleration and it's celebration. Mm-hmm. And then everything else flows from that. And every other issue in the world you can talk about flows from that. You know, do you respect the fact that you don't want half the world to be flooded? Then get off your ass and quit, you know, making global warming worse. I mean, you know.
Well, I'm glad you're weaving these threads together because I think there's at least three threads here that I see that are really related. One,
that's good because I'm usually a dot connector. Today I'm a thread weaver.
No, well, so one okay. Thread is the diversity thread, you know, celebrating diversity, not just tolerating it, but embracing diversity. Another thread is one we've already mentioned, people seeing the best possibilities for themselves, not being fatalist. And I worry about this because I think I've seen, at least here in the Bay Area in California, I see this all the time. If you go from town to town to town, you see radical economic differences. Some people are empowered. Some people have access to good education. Some people, you know, embrace the technology around them, learn the skills, and other people don't. They're being left behind. That happens culturally. It happens racially. It happens economically, all over the place. And then there's this you know, futurism element of Star Trek, embracing technology and seeing that as a tool that can make humanity better rather than something to fear. And in my mind, I think of Star Trek as being able to help people envision possibilities for themselves. I mean, this is something that Whoopi Goldberg conveyed in seeing Nichelle Nichols on the bridge of the Enterprise, right? Seeing a black woman as an officer on a starship, that's not something you could have envisioned in the 1960s very easily for a lot of people. And
Mama, there's a colored lady on TV and she ain't a maid.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so you mm-hmm. know, I worry that people are not necessarily just being tolerated by others. I worry people are pigeonholing themselves. They're viewing themselves as coming from a certain environment, mm-hmm. stuck in their situation, and they don't envision those possibilities. And I just, the most important thing that I see that Star Trek does for people as individuals is to see other possibilities for the way the world could be, for what their lives could be, and not just say, you know, yeah, okay, say you're a waitress in a diner, right? That's today, but tomorrow, what can you do? What can you make yourself? How can you contribute to the world? How can you live the life that you really want to live and not just the life that's been thrust upon you? And Star Trek just sets this really high vision for human possibility. At a very personal, individual level, I think. And that means something different to every person. I mean, I've got my story about that. You've got yours. Mike, you've got yours. And I mean, every listener out there is going to have a different story about how Star Trek has inspired their own life. But I guess that's what I really want to see. I want to see people be empowered rather than pigeonholed because of all those factors we mentioned.
Yeah. No, good point. That's if you're in a situation where you're not inherently, I mean, part of this is the old American, you know, Horatio Alger, Horatio Alger story, you know, the bootstrap story, but it's hard to do that. I mean, there's a lot of things in my life. I mean, I wish I had realized that business did not mean sales. It also meant management, or I might have, you know, done some things differently in life. Or the way the entertainment industry works, it was amazing to read the making of Star Trek when you're a kid and know and not get it at the time. You absorb it, but you're not conscious aware of it until a few years later, when it shocked me to realize that there weren't books like that floating around about how other TV shows were made mm-hmm. in the 60s and 70s and 80s. I mean, now we're so, you know, media saturated, and people are, you know, doing podcasts and doing movies on their laptop, I hear. and, you know, we are so media savvy and media literate and maybe even media tired, as I said a long time ago for Connor Rapp. But it's amazing to me what a landmark book, Stephen Whitfield Poe's book, The Making of Star Trek, was, because it didn't just talk about Star Trek. It talked about how production comes together and all the different elements. And, you know, when I'm reading in there and in David's book, The World of Star Trek, too, about, you know, Bob Justman could take a script to hold it in his hand and tell you to the penny how much it would cost to make it, you know. And then to see that, and just to read that and kind of just take that as a, oh, okay. And then realize later on what that, you know, what a break, how you break down a script and how you set it out and what a production meeting happens and how all the production heads, just as one little particular thing. But to realize that when you're a kid reading that book and you're in the middle of Oklahoma, not out in the boonies, but, you know, you're in a world that moved much slower, and you got your Star Trek news through Starlog and your Interstat. I mean, years before Entertainment Tonight would, you know, bring you little bits and pieces stuff. But being able to expand your world beyond where you are, and how with every decade that goes by, that gets easier, and we have media to thank a little bit for that. And even the pictures that people see, like not every show now is in New York and LA. There's this big movement, whether they're shooting there or not, how so many shows, you know, are set in big towns and small, just as one level. That's like the most obvious literal level. But just showing people different locales for drama to be, or comedies to be set in, much less if entertainment and acting and production is your way of life, but not just that. We need media. Media is the channel, but whether it's science or technology or social progress, whatever it is that you can do, and not only like, oh, here's the exciting things, but just the level of, you know, if you grow up in a certain place where a certain thing is not the dominant industry or the dominant way, you have no idea that it's not just this visible level that you see, but there are like 92 support levels behind that. And the glowy, shiny thing is, you know, TV production, movie production. And you don't know if you're a creative person, all of that. But you know, music, the music industry, or anything, the medical industry, the research, the academic, you know, industry, academia. I'm spitballing here, but you don't know unless you grow up in the oil field and you see oil pipeline supply places down the road, five of them. You get that. Oh, there's all these niches of, you know, there's the, forget the name for the guy that goes out to survey. But, you know, you get that. But if it's not something that's near you, you know, geographically, you have no idea. And I guess we talk about mobility, and in times of better economy, people are more mobile. In times of stressed economies, people are stuck and they can't get out. But more and more, as the world has evolved, technology and culture finds ways to compensate for, you know, that's how we progress on all different levels. And one of the ways we've done that is having a media more and more. We're not just in the, you know, Gutenberg Bible days was a huge revolution, but now with a woodcut illustration of the wonders of the world. But now we're to where we have the internet bringing us things going on around the world, whether it's for good or it's in a saving, you know, revolutions and social movements and just news and suppressed information that gets out because people have cameras. Oh my God, you know.
There's a paradox to it. Because, I mean, there's never been a time.
So anyway, I'm wandering down the line here, but I mean, all of that is combining to help lift those boats, you know, rising tide lifting all those boats for people. And good or bad economy, that ability, you know, people are buying cell phones before they buy anything else. And that one thing there is a window to the world, even if they're out in the middle of Africa or South America or China. Or, I mean, wherever they are in some part that's not a, you know, a first world country. And more and more they're having a key that unlocks.
Well, the paradox that I see access. Is that there's never been a time in the whole history of the world that it's been easier to learn anything, right? You can get on the internet, you can learn it, you know, get some practice on something, get a new skill, whatever, you can learn it, right? And same thing with creative powers. You mentioned all the creativity in producing something, you know, the world of television production as an example, right? You can learn to do that from your laptop nowadays. You have these creative tools. We're making podcasts right here from our desks, right? You know, all these tools exist. But the paradox is people don't have a vision for themselves. They don't know the tools exist. They don't, even if they know the tools exist, they don't think of them as tools. And so, you know, what do you want to do with your life? You know, I appreciate the fact that Star Trek has helped people become scientists and artists and mathematicians and, you know, the things that make the world go forward. And I just think
sociologists, anthropologists, ambassadors, actual public servants, without attaching a dirty word to the word politician.
There are a lot of ambassadors in the next generation. But I think, you know, the combination of the empowering tools that we've got combined with a vision for what the world could be or what people can do as individuals is a pretty powerful combination. And in my mind, I just see Star Trek filling that latter role. It gives people individually a vision for themselves. It gives the world a vision for how the world could be a better place. And exposure, because you're right, people do get pigeonholed into their little world. And, you know, exposing people to a different vision of what humanity could be.
You used to have to pay for a lot of therapy to get that kind of creative visionary training. And now you can just do it watching Star Trek. Even 30-year-old Star Trek.
This is interesting, is that there is a therapeutic component to Star Trek, right? In fact, I self-medicate with Star Trek all the time. I put it on to relax the evening, absolutely.
I've been reading a lot of people doing that the last few weeks. Must be something going on in the world. I don't know. Yeah.
You know, so in my mind, this existential component of Star Trek, just the self-empowerment, you know, giving you a vision for what your life could be is really important. And it's something I feel like we've lost. I just feel like it's been such a rough few years for a lot of people. I mean, I know people have lost their houses. They've lost their jobs. You know, they can't make ends meet. They aren't respected and they're stuck. And, you know, they just need, and it's not, I don't want it to be a bootstrap thing, because you used the word bootstrap a little while ago. There is this danger of saying, well, pick yourself up and do something with your life. And not everyone's able to do that. But, you know, I worry that the problem is even deeper than that, that people have just kind of lost the vision for what life could be. And that's a sad state of affairs. I hate to say that about the world around me, because I try not to approach my own life that way. And I like to help people see possibilities. And, you know, and so Star Trek is great about envisioning possibilities. As Spock would say, there are always possibilities, right?
Always possibilities.
And that's a really important message. You know, no matter what happened yesterday or the day before, a year ago, you can wake up the next day and you can make a plan, use your reasoning skills, put a plan together and make something happen in the world. And everyone is able to do that in some way, almost regardless of their situation, I think. And it all starts with having a vision.
And maybe as the years go by and we have supported technology in a more enlightened culture, it becomes easier for people to have hooks to be able to do that, and remedies and steps and structural backing to be able to do that. And it just, when you were talking about the creative possibilities and inspiring possibilities, even that's just two shout outs here. What Rod Roddenberry has done with his foundation is, well, if I'm not going to be a hard, you know, he's an executive producer for Discovery, that's great. But he's obviously not been into hardcore, you know, writing and production like his dad was. And for him to be finding his way in the world, what he can do and still use the Roddenberry name and the promise and the premise of Star Trek, and to the projects that his foundation is looking into, you know, game-changing, you know, what are some of the things they can lend their time and talent and money to, and emphasis, and lend that name to, and that's the kind of thing, like empowering people and showing the possibilities, and what are paradigm shifts that we can do here that will get us there, and in a small way, that's also what my Enterprise in Space project that I talk about is doing, trying to be on a global way, and I mean, I've learned so much about just with the global state of education and science and outreach. And we do hear so much about what's going wrong with the world and the trouble spots. And it seems like maybe we're slipping back at times. But there's some amazing things happening in amazing corners of the world. And sometimes we need to get ourselves out of our little ruts and realize that there is good happening, despite the headlines that we're drowning into that's selling, used to say selling papers, now it's selling clicks, I guess. But again, that's, and a lot of that is Star Trek driven, if not a Star Trek is part of the drive to it. And embracing that hopefulness. And yeah, Star Trek not being a panacea or Pollyanna-ish, but the implication, mm-hmm. whether it's stated overtly or not, is that, yes, we did, but with Idik and respect, the implication is this, we did survive. Well, and that's a pat thing to say, but what is implied in the, yes, we survived, didn't blow ourselves up, we didn't destroy the planet. What's implied in that? And, and then, like Ira would say during DS9, well, we're always talking about the Star Trek, Gene's, non-dystopian, perfect world, paradise, Earth. How did we get there? How did we get from here to there? And then shows like Future Tense, the two-parter mm-hmm. with the Bell Riots. He was as a storyteller trying to find another, instead of just showing the rosy, the Emerald City at the end of the Yellow Brick Road, which are totally mixed metaphors. How do we get from here to there? How do we escape the sleeping poppies?
Star Trek has witch and everything, Star Trek has faith in the general rationality of people at large. That if you show people a better way, they're rational enough. Eventually, there's obstacles, there's impediments, psychological or otherwise, but eventually, people will see a better way and they'll come around to it.
And that's that was the whole premise. Aside from just cannon fodder for kids like me, for Enterprise and all the world. That said, oh, it's a prequel. Star Trek is about going forward, not backward. That's my fanboy voice, and I would always say, I'm sorry, but the last time I checked, 2161 is in the 2151 is in the future, and the value of Enterprise and anything else in that pre-Kirk, pre-Picard time is doing what you just said or what Ira was talking about with Future Tense is showing how we get there, and even the people who aren't as perfect, who aren't as advanced and got it together and their culture around them is together as Kirk and then even increasingly Picard and Sisko Janeway. Like how? Because we're still stuck here. We can still use some inspiration. We can still use, if not like a guidebook and a connect the dots, but we can still use some of that closer in. And we do know the end game in Star Trek land. So having, seeing the midpoints is helpful aside from, being cool storytelling and all that. So that's another angle of the whole, I never understood the anti-prequel crowd. I want to see more advanced stories too, but I want it all. And it's a big galaxy, Mr. Scott, it's a big sandbox yeah. and there's plenty of places to go. But on your show's level here on that, I hadn't thought of it in that way, but it's also helpful to show some midpoints, to show some, how did they get to the South Pole? Well, they stashed a cache of stuff, supplies along the way, and didn't make it. They didn't make it in one loop. Scott didn't, but Amundsen.
I mean, this is the $64,000 question, of course. But the challenge is, there's a danger when you have any sort of specific fandom, I think. There's a danger of being so esoteric that you don't appeal to people at large. And if you want Star Trek to have this empowering effect on the world at large to really change the world, if that's part of Star Trek's mission is to make an impact, then you don't just want to make an impact on people who are already drinking the Kool-Aid, right? That's not enough. So how do you simultaneously just find the balance between right. appealing to people who aren't already Star Trek fans, helping people who are stuck in their own mindset, their own worldview, their own location, see possibilities for themselves, and yet still stay true to Gene Roddenberry, and yet still be fun and interesting Star Trek and entertainment. It's a tall, tall order, and it's no accident that people have angst about the inability to meet that order. But
well, and what you just said, that's been the stated. Every movie, every new series starts off there, commercially. Mm-hmm. How do we reach out? They all, it's the meme now that's thanks to our media saturated age, everybody knows what they used to always say was, we can't do this movie just for Star Trek fans. We'd never, you know, we wouldn't survive. We wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't be around for a second movie. And that's always been the dynamic tension creatively and financially. And congratulations, you've just brought it in existentially. of how do we keep it, what makes Star Trek Star Trek, and then how do we appeal to a broader base? You know, like, we can't just do this movie for fanboys and fangirls. You know, we've got to have a bigger, you know, and then, and so the more successful movies, because they're one shots, they're easier to control, but then they may be the harder task, because you've got to do it all in one shot versus a series you can evolve, but a series is a bigger time and money investment, you know, and especially time. But that's that, you're right. I was shocked to hear you say the $64,000 question. I thought that was one of those terms that's fading into obscurity, but I guess that's MeTV.
Showing my age here for sure.
Yeah, yeah. No, now we can just blame all the retro channels. Now we can just do that. But it is, and because, you know, no matter how wonderful, gloriously world-changing your little concept is, we still live in a capitalistic society, and if you can't keep it on the air, yada, yada. Now, of course, we have this little radical element called the internet and people doing their own little web shows, and sometimes those break out and can reach millions of people, but there's still limiting factors there. So if you're trying to get it to the biggest platform you can, you're still in that balancing act.
I mean, this is kind of the practical trade-off between pragmatism and utopianism, right? Star Trek has a great utopian vision, but here in the 21st century, we live in a capitalistic society with all these capitalistic tools around us. And if that enables us to take a utopian type message and get it out to more people and empower them, then that's a great tool to use. I'm all for it, frankly. I wouldn't be anti-capitalistic in that sense, despite Star Trek's, you know, anti-capitalistic, relatively utopian vision. I think we do live in that type of society, and that's one of the tools that's on the table to use.
See, Si, and I have to apologize to my friend that wrote the Economy of Star Trek book, but it's like what's implied, you know, we'd love to sit around, and especially since Next Generation, and it comes up, and the story writers like scratch their heads, and fans go, what the hell does that mean? They don't have money. And, you know, if you go, well, if replicators can make gold, then, you know, what, you know, it's like science wins.
Prices go,
you know,
up.
Over, you know, science rips up the paradigms of what we've lived with for ages. You know, we go, now we're back to hunter-gatherer versus, you know, the hunter-gatherer dynamic and, it, you know, the road we went on since then. But that's what that is. But again, that's what, talking about the economic model of getting the story out, telling the story has also been interesting. But that's what was so, what you were just saying about Star Trek showing this utopian vision in the capitalistic system. Part, you know, now we take it for granted, but that was such a radical, subversive idea. That's another thing about the 60s that it's almost hard to realize now, because now, oh, it's just the way Star Trek is. Oh, you know, but we take it for granted now that, you know, the impetus for Star Trek was when Gene's script about racism, well, you know, he loved, you know, Gulliver's Travels and Jonathan Swift, and he loved Fern and, you know, the Star Trek, the science fiction giants of the day. But Gene got so pissed when he was trying to tell adult stories, quote unquote, on Have Gun Will Travel. And he did, and he won, you know, awards, won a Writers Guild Award. And he's trying to do that with The Lieutenant, which is amazing to me now they were doing that. This is 64, right before Vietnam and the country's attitude about military and involvement went south. But the fact that he was doing a military show, because he was military, or came out of that background, but he was World War II generation, so everybody was military background. But the fact that his script about racism, the issue of race in the military and the black couple at his fictional Marine base, mm-hmm. The fact that that show was censored and pissed him off is what finally kicked him over into doing the, well, hell, I'll do science fiction and I'll put them on, you know, purple skinned people, you know, on polka dot animals on a wacky deuce rocket ship. And then I can tell my stories and the suits won't get it, but the people will, because the people are inherently smart out there. And that was like the first step of subversion, the subversive attitude that led to Star Trek. And then after the show was on the air, and it wasn't just a, hey, you know, you read the way Gene talks about the suits, like in the original memos and his conversations in the making of Star Trek. Hey, Gene, baby, just throw some blinky lights on a board. Who cares? You know, like, it's
fine. I think that's a brilliant insight because I mean, so much of...
And we forget how... And then now what Mark Cushman's books have been showing since he broke through to the actual Nielsens and showing that the old meme we've had for 50 years about, oh, the ratings weren't so good, it just took a while for culture to grow up to get it in the 70s and the new kids, you know, the boomers after school to get it. It's like, no, Star Trek had awesome ratings at the time. It was just that Gene as a producer sticking up for his project pissed off so many people more and more at NBC. I'm shocked. The Lieutenant was on NBC. I'm shocked that NBC ever, that's Herb Solo. I'm shocked that NBC ever took a chance with this troublemaker guy again, but they did. And it came back to them in their view. It came back to them in spades. But by the second season, the cancellation, the third season, it was not about ratings. It was about this guy. And I don't think NBC was going, you're telling too many, panacea, wackadoodle, perfect world stories here and challenging the status quo of the established order. It wasn't, they weren't doing that. We're corporatist and capitalist and you're being subversive. It wasn't that. It was in service of doing those stories, he was butting heads. It was all about, you know, just the way anything is. It's personalities and egos and carrying all that. So on one hand, it's a nice thing that NBC is what encouraged the diversity in casting, that the Star Trek loves to take so much, you know, we're selling TV sets and we're trying to broaden the base and yada, yada. In a world of, you know, back in a three-channel world, guys. Mm-hmm. So it was such a rare thing to have a show on. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm spitballing a lot because I haven't put all this together in my own head until just now. So you're getting it fresh. But it's we forget how subversive and radical Star Trek was, even in its quiet way. And this revolution that first showed up as fans and viewers, you know, just in numbers, because it's all about making money. So that when local stations had this bonanza of 4 o'clock and 5 o'clock and 6 o'clock Star Trek reruns after school, and that's what revolutionized Star Trek, and it also revolutionized the industry and syndication. And then a book like the Star Trek Technical Manual was the number one New York Times bestseller for 12 or 15 weeks, whatever it was. And people are like, oh my God, what? This is a fictional world. And people are paying money to have
it.
How's that for nerd porn? But I mean, the revolutions in pop culture that started to happen in the 70s and laid the groundwork for Star Wars mm-hmm. and everything that came. You know, we've just been the last 5-10 years pointing back to Star Trek as bigger than even its, you know, the ripples that it caused even beyond itself. And now going back a few more years to remembering what an amazing thing it was to get it on the air and then keep it on the air. But it may have been not even because of the message. I mean, that's how well hidden. My point is, that's how well in the weeds between the cracks Gene's little attempt here, and why, you know, people go, oh, well, the 70s and the 80s, he was Mr. Philosopher King, he wasn't a producer anymore, and his wacky doodle thing about, you know, no human conflict on Next Generation was so, you know, Gene was more of a philosopher than a writer, and how the hell do we make this work? But yeah.
Well, I think Gene had a. I think he had.
It started in the 60s.
He had a commendable insight, though, which is that you always have constraints placed on you, and sometimes you get the smackdown from people who don't get your vision. And if you just do the right thing, and sometimes you have to do it subversively, you have to do it in a way that it's not obvious. Yes. The right people, you have to have faith in people. The right people will get it, mm-hmm. and the wrong people, if they really don't get it, and you've been successful at being subversive, they're irrelevant. You've made them irrelevant, right? You've achieved what you want to achieve.
We're in the 50th anniversary, and I have been watching every documentary, everything that on television I could get my hands on. History Channel did a great 2-hour documentary. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Hallmark Channel yesterday had a Next Generation reunion show, and so I've been watching these things for the love of Spock and just everything I can get my hands on, because this is the 50th and we're only going to do this, I think, once. But one of the things that really amazes me, and Zachary, you made the distinction a little bit ago about the philosophy of Star Trek and philosophy in Star Trek and how these philosophical issues have inspired and been inspired by Star Trek. And what amazes me is that every one of these documentaries, every one of these shows I watch, even the conversation yesterday on the Hallmark Channel for this Next Generation reunion, they always point back to these kind of social, political, philosophical issues. It always goes back to that core message, Itik, and, you know, the prime directive and these existential crises. And I think if there is any franchise out there with a gravitas to pull this off, it's Star Trek, being able to, as Larry pointed out, being able to present these existential crises and show us how to get from here to there, how to get to Gene's vision of the future. And I'm really excited that we're not going, you know, I don't get me wrong, Larry, I want to go 20 years past Voyager or whatever. I want to see that,
yeah.
But I'm really interested in seeing more of how we get from here to there. And I think that honestly is a message. It's definitely something I think that we as a society need to see. And I think the time is right for another iteration of Star Trek and these new and interesting ways really to tell the same stories that we've been telling for, you know, thousands of years. I mean, Plato's cave and the trolley problem and these things that are old, but yet they're new and they're relevant again because of these issues and problems that we're dealing with as a society. I think if there's any franchise out there with a gravitas to pull it off, it's Star Trek.
Well, it's been a long road getting from 30 years.
Indeed.
Well, there's a danger, too, of making Star Trek so serious that we forget about the human part of existence. I mean, what I love about the next generation.
That's the storytelling versus
totally. The
here and now storytelling in your face and stay commercially viable versus all the deeper you can do if it's layered in there and 30 years later, people are still watching that show.
Even though it was a little.
How many other things from the late 60s are people watching? And analyzing to death, right?
Right. Even though it was a little corny, like in the 80s, I love that they put, you know, that they played classical music in 10 forward. And I love that Data painted Modrian paintings and Monet paintings. You know, it shows that there's more to life than technology. There's more to life than social agendas, which, however important they are, sometimes, you know, these mm-hmm. more humanistic liberal arts kinds of things matter. And that's part of a complete human life. And, you know, I guess this is all part of finding the balance, right? You can be have such an agenda politically and socially that you forget about the fun of Star Trek and the adventure of Star Trek. And you can be so focused on the adventure that you forget to put an important social message in Star Trek sometimes. And you just, you know, that what I love about a TV show is that you have room to do all these things. You can't do all of that in a movie. And in a series, hopefully you have enough wiggle room where you can have a message and you can have some fun and you can have an adventure and you can listen to some music and whatever they're going to do in the new series. But I think you know, these are just all of these are important features of a complete human life. And Star Trek dabbles in every aspect of a complete human life, I think.
What you were just talking about a minute ago, Mike, about why a defense of a prequel is what it boiled down to. And but it also shows the difficulty when Star Trek is so popular. I mean, there are times when there have been things, especially the last few months, and not to get political, but there's been times when I just go, or, you know, it happens at any time in any fan thread. There's times there was an old joke on the pitch target that came up that was done as a joke, reactions to people when they come in to pitch a story, and the bullseye, it's done as a target, and the bullseye is, congratulations, you know, we'll buy it. And then there's this increasingly outer ring, and one of the outer ring answers is, do you even watch the show? You know, and there's times when I see people who are Star Trek fans, they must be because they're on the boards and they're on threads and they're on Facebook pages talking, and they'll say things. And I'm just like, are you like, how are you a Star Trek fan? You know, or what, you know, not to be egalitarian or snooty about it, or, you know, limiting at all. We're all one big happy fleet. But, you know, there's times when I just go, and what about this franchise attracts you? Because like the way I do not think you know what that franchise means, you know, and not to cross streams too badly, but anyway, to hear you talking about, there are so many people that are in the like forward or nothing, and the case we're making on a whole different level here, which is amazing, not just for fanboy porn for canon, but the psychological, emotional, metaphysical level of seeing milestones or the steps along the way. I'm glad the way you voiced that was really good to hear. that it was out on a public airwave, like a podcast.
And of course, for me, as a philosopher, one of the things that I really do enjoy, and I like this about the latter seasons of The Next Generation and some things they did in Voyager, I like the what Brannon Braga brought to the table back then in terms of these abstract philosophical, metaphysical, mm-hmm. ethical mm-hmm. ideas. And, you know, and they're not necessarily practical.
This is episode 47, so I have to do a shout out here to Joe Manosky, who's going to be in the writing staff of Discovery. But Joe Manosky was like, he's the one person of Star Trek over the years, there's probably others, but he's the one major player that I never did an interview with. And I would, back when, in the old days, and I was in and out of the Hart Building a lot, and or some anyway, increasingly over the years, but even in Next Gen, the Voyager days, and I'd see him and go, okay. And he was kind of an odd bird, to say the least. He wasn't all caught up in Hollywood. He wasn't caught up in the ego of being a writer. He was just a storyteller, and he took a 2 years thing to go back to Italy and live with his greater family, and he would in the day he would fax his stories, and they kept using him as a writer, as a story source, if not a script writer, both. And he would fax things over, and they would, you know, put up with all that, still keep having him involved. And then he did come back and then worked on Voyager a lot. And he worked with Brian a lot, and he worked with Brian a lot as when Brian was a boy writer. And he's not quite as bad as Gene Kuhn about not being out in the mainstream and having his thoughts and his personality out there, but he's kept to himself. And that's one of the things I regret is I finally saw an interview he gave, I think, to Tisha Palmer somewhere along the way. And I was like, damn it, I thought that wasn't personal. And it wasn't, it's just him. But you have to go back and look at his credits and even some of the stories that he pitched that went so far and didn't make it, because Joe Manosky, you're talking about that out of the box mentality. And Brannon was the same way in a different streak, but his would get wrestled. Joe would have these amazing ideas like Darmok, okay, mm-hmm. that were totally paradigm busting. He'd like, whoa. And then he had some other ideas that were, whoa. And they would work on them and work on them. And everybody knew it was a cool concept, but whether it was for all eternity or just because they were all exhausted or because it was the world of TV writing in the 80s or the 90s or whatever, they could not wrangle it and wrestle it into, you know, four acts and a teaser or five acts and a teaser. They could mm-hmm. not make it, or on a budget, on a pre-CGI, whatever it was, they could not, you know. And masks is an idea of a wacky out of the box that by the time it gets down to the nuts and bolts of production and we have budgets with departments having to make this thing work in front of a camera, it didn't work as well as maybe it could have. But he was always in there pitching and he was always in there swinging. And I'm just saying, and not to cut you off the knees there, but talking about Brannon, because that's very true. But and Brian was another one that came along in Voyager with the same kind of attitude. And you know, the more Trek went on, there was always the limiting factor there of first whoever was the showrunner, was Michael or whoever, Brannon later, Jerry in the middle. And then ultimately, you know, Rick Berman putting a lid on, scaling back some of the wacky doodleness, you know. Of some of these things where now we read the book, oh my God, this is so awesome, this is prescient. But, you know, it's the things that would drive Ron and Brian and Brannon and all these people to go off and do their own story, and now I'm going to do it my way. And they're still subject, like you said, they're still subject to limitations, human nature, TV time, TV budgets. But they're doing it, they're fine, you know, and maybe 10 years go by and maybe the world has shifted where it's more doable in a concrete way. But that impetus with that storytelling. And all I'm trying to say here is that Joe Manosky is a quiet guy over here who I don't think has gotten the credit. And people say, yeah, but for every Darmok, there's a Masks. Well, that's part of just us. Maybe we haven't been able to, as humans, to embrace the Manoskyism that it deserved to be, well, you know, but okay.
I think this is just the kind of thing that, you know, people just have
so to. So I'm excited. It's another reason why I'm excited to see what role he plays and what Discovery can do in 2016, 2017.
It's the kind of thing that you have to make a conscious effort to include, right? I mean, man doesn't live by Starfleet rations alone, right? We need ideas and we need to be inspired and we need to realize, I guess, a fundamental insight of Star Trek, I think, is that we don't understand everything there is to understand. There's still mystery. There's still adventure. Mm-hmm. There's still unknowns. And that's all philosophy is. I mean, things we don't really understand about ourselves and the universe around us and these seeming paradoxes and things that lead our intuitions right. Different directions.
And you have time in which which we live and how it affects us.
Absolutely. And you have to make a you have to make a conscious effort to put those stories in. And I guess you can be so focused on telling a particular kind of story, a particular kind of adventure, having a particular kind of social message that you forget, you know, just how important it is for us to keep asking those hard questions, things we don't understand. So for me personally, Star Trek has always been about the mystery. There's things in the universe we don't know. We're going to go out and find out. There's, you know, things philosophically that we don't understand about ourselves, or things that look like paradoxes, what knowledge is, what the ultimate nature of reality is. And these are questions, they don't matter day to day. They don't matter for getting yourself fed and getting out the door and bringing income home, right? But they matter. That's one of those things that makes us uniquely human. And there's very few vehicles out there that are as good at asking these abstract philosophical, metaphysical questions than Star Trek. I mean, some radical fantasy genres do that too, but you know, something that's scientifically plausible, grounded in a future that looks plausible, not just something that is so fantastical that it's pure fantasy. Star Trek is firmly grounded in reality, and yet it still explores those abstract ideas.
Mm-hmm. And I try to talk about this because, like, since day one, people, why is Star Trek so popular and blah blah blah, and it's. And I kept using the last year or so at conventions, I think I've mentioned it on a podcast or two, I kept using C words to describe this, but it's like there are classic shows and series and franchises, and there are shows that are celebrated, you know, years later. There are shows that are analyzed. There are shows that have fandoms. But it's like there's only, especially things that grew out of television, there's only one Star Trek and one... And on the, you know, and not just as a fandom pop culture, oh, I want to dress up like this, but like you said, affecting people to be scientists and teachers and doctors and engineers and social servants and helping professions and all that. And it's come back around. Another reason why I feel like we've come full circle from the 60s, like we were saying at the beginning, our outer world situation making us more anxious and more stressed, maybe, and not as quite as cushy as some other times here in the middle. But the way that, you know, Star Trek is not in a vacuum. There's other television, other movies, other literature that are out there trying to do the same thing, you know, exist as storytelling vehicles because there's other creative people doing that. And what we had a lot in the 60s was bowing to the world of, you know, the post-apocalyptic dystopian view, and that's what made Star Trek stand out then. That's another way we've come back to it. So now we've got, you know, the vampire, and we've got Walking Dead, and we have Breaking Bad, mm-hmm. and we have all these wonderful dramatic vehicles that are telling thought-provoking stories and characters, but they're just doing it in such a dark mirror, mm-hmm. a dark lens. And it's coming back around to, on top of having great stories that are thought-provoking with great characters, with great acting, and even with commentary and thematic, the canvas that they're built on is so depressing that that's the thing that makes Star Trek stand out, is on top of all of that, they're doing all that with that canvas, with that universe of optimism. And that's the thing I think not only sets Star Trek apart, but that's the thing we've circled back around to appreciating again, and make Star Trek stand out like it is fresh and new. When, no, guys, that's what we've done all along.
Even those shows that have kind of a positive, an overall positive vision. I'm thinking of a show like Terra Nova. You know, they're kind of escapist. Like, let's just leave the world behind and go somewhere else and make a utopia. Right? Star Trek tries to stick it out in the here and now. You know, we make a better world here in our future. We're not trying to leave it. We're not gonna jump ship. We're gonna stick here and stick it out and make the world a better place. I think that's really commendable and rare.
Yeah, it's not a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Right.
It's not. Exactly. It's not Space 1999. It's not. Yeah, exactly. That's what, I mean, there are so many things that being a kid and just loving Star Trek after school, and then years later trying to go back and see, well, what was it? And one of the things that I always loved that I didn't really, I mean, I just took it for granted. That's one thing about Leonard dying, and I've written about this too, is how it really, you know, McCoy was always my favorite character. I always loved Dee. In a show that I loved the show and I loved all the characters. Okay. But when you come down to favorites, and I'm talking original series because for 20 years, that's all there was. And I say 20 years, 10 years for me. And everything else that's come along, in my, you know, always love your first. You always remember your first. You can't forget your first. So everybody has their own story, but it's like when Leonard died, it made me realize it was a different reaction that I had when Dee died, and even Jimmy and all the rest of the cast, and people that I had known personally. So that's a different paradigm too. And I had not known Leonard Nimoy that well. I only interacted with him a couple of times other than being as a fan, but just the gravitas, the gut level. I said at the time, it felt like the universe shifted more than like mourning mourned and personal loss, but it's like the universe shifted. And it made me start thinking how I'd always taken Spock for granted and Leonard Nimoy, you know, acting and all that, but how Spock I'd taken for granted. And then it's like, in turn, even Star Trek for granted in some ways. It's like, well, yeah, duh. Well, that's Star Trek. Well, of course it is. All these things we've been saying here. It's like, and then even at the time, the unexamined things. And it really, even a year ahead of the 50th, that got me thinking, not like I'm writing academic papers and I'm publishing, not perishing or something, but it got me thinking about the unexamined Trek, the taken for granted Trek, and how maybe after all these years of piling on and getting esoteric about the width of rank braid and what year so-and-so could have happened in the future timeline, all these little anal little fanboy things, or just enjoying the production quality of a series as it goes along, all those basic elements of the things not examined. And some of the things we've been talking here today. So what you said about, it just reminded me of thinking we're still peeling. It's 50 years on, and all the series hopefully are worthy of this. But it's, I still go back to the root, and wherever people came in with their fandom, it's like it's always worth it to go back to the root and keep peeling these onion layers back and re-examining in the lens of what we know now. And
well, at the very least, I hope that people who are listening to our show in particular find new layers, that they see things in the shows that they didn't see before, get them to think about ideas they haven't thought about before. Because I think our educational system is in danger of being so pragmatic that we don't ask these deeper questions. So I hope that we've succeeded there a little
critical
bit here.
Critical
thinking and philosophical thinking. But and then and secondarily, I hope that we make some sort of impact, that we inspire someone to take up the mantle and take up these challenges, at very least make their lives better, you know, make a better version of Star Trek that solves real problems in the world. I hope someone's listening.
This show is, I'm sorry. Stomped all over again. I was going to say, this show is, like I said, I came in going, I always wanted to take a philosophy class. I can't sit here and do labels and all that. But what you guys are doing here is, I guess I stumble and do it as an amateur at times, or as the years have gone by and as we had no active show to talk about. I saw that there was kind of a crying need for that somewhere between the meta of Star Trek and the meta of Hollywood and production. And the first time I was at a convention, I still remember this, it was Dallas in 2010. And I got to a convention without being able to do a slideshow talk. I was like, oh my God, how am I going to talk to people? I had a room with 300 people. And we just started talking and I just went, well, you know, there's a lot of things I don't think people get. And at that point in time, the first movie had come out and people were like, well, why aren't the new actors coming to conventions? Like, well, they're movie guys and they're not locked in a series and it's a different paradigm. And that's a very on the nose, you know, thing to talk about. But a lot of issues from there on down, I realized they knew this and they knew point A and point B and point C and hadn't connected, or thread A, B, C now, I guess, today. There was just a vacuum. There was just a space there to do that, especially when there was no act. It was almost like, if we're not going to have shows for a while, we're not going to be caught up in the week-to-week, you know, flood of new information coming, canon and production and all of that coming. If we're going to be in this fallow time, maybe it is a good time to start this discussion and start that. And, of course, that's the podcast revolution has happened. Mm-hmm. We've had such a diversity of media of all kinds, and Metatrex is another good way of doing it. So, you know, good on you guys for it. Even here, as we ramp up for a show, it's only going to be a 13-week show. It's only one series, and we'll still have plenty of, you know, air in the room to be talking about this on all these different new channels and all these different new, you know, technical platforms. and all these different spaces. Now, here's maybe we're trying to wrap up. I don't know, but here's one more closing thought that's made me really excited about almost like a small D democracy here in Trek fandom is the Discovery's coming. We've had tons of new fans come in the last 5-10 years in the fallow time. I mean, it's one of the coolest things is to see people online on the optimistic side of things who say, I am so excited, like younger fans or newer fans who all they've known is Star Trek as a row of boxes on the shelf or avatars on their Netflix screen. You know, they've never had the experience of watching new shows come out and dissecting them and anticipating them and second guessing the leaks and all that, you know, the spoilers, and then watching them, and then watching show after. They've never had that experience that so many of the rest of us take for granted. But we've had a whole generation come along now that's never had that. And I seeing somebody post about how excited they were to finally have, you shouldn't say their Star Trek, but have Star Trek experience it week to week and unfolding that way. And it reminded me that it's actually going to be new for everybody because it's going to be obviously new for them. They who grew up in a social media 24/7 world. I'm leaping there. But then all of us old, established, you know, mature fans, we've never seen Star Trek unfold in that kind of world. Mm-hmm. So this next year is going to be an experience new for all everybody, wherever they're coming from. Yeah. And that's like the best, you know, same stage, level platform, small D democratic way of approaching Star Trek. I mean, I'm really excited. It's going to be amazing to see people bringing their old baggage or their old experience from where they came into fandom, you know, and have that collide with the world we live in now. Oh, it's like I said about fighting the new war with the way you did the last one at first. Mm-hmm. And people still bring their examined and their unexamined expectations, even on a cultural, experiential fan level, will be different. And watching people go, oh, and after a week or two or three go, you know, just adjusting and whether people are conscious of it or not, because we can't help it. The culture and the media landscape and the fandom audience experience has changed so much in 10 years, 12 years now, that it can't help but be a different experience. And we all talk about binge watching and, you know, just the way people do things. The whole, you know, like my kids would never, you know, he hates writing a paper check. And oh my God, you know, appointment TV is not a thing anymore. And just binge watching or dumping. You know, I've heard people say, oh, they're going to dump them once a week. Well, I'm just going to wait till they're all 13 or there and then sit down and do it my way and watch. You know, I'm like, no, you won't. If you're really a fan, you will have to get sucked in by the week-to-week discussion. You know, it's like, so for them, that's like their world is going to collide with, well, you know, it's just,
it seems like,
I'm just throwing a lot of stuff
previously, out here, up until now, Star Trek episodes have kind of been their own bookends. It was very difficult to find other fans to interact with, to continue the discussion. And now each new episode can be the beginning of a conversation. People will follow up on Twitter or Facebook or here in the Babel conference with Trek FM. People will podcast about it, and that starts the conversation. And I think up till now, you know, even when Star Trek has done a great job of conveying philosophical ideas or ethical issues, whatnot, that's kind of been there's been a period at the end of it. Like, here's Star Trek's take on it, period, on to the next episode. And that's just not how social media works. And that aspect has really changed. I hope there's amazing, profound conversations that emerge out of whatever Discovery ends up being.
I really like the way you guys have sort of framed this up, you know, as we wind things down here, Larry, relative to what you were saying a moment ago about hits and misses with episodes, I have found that as I've gone back and watched previous episodes of, say, Next Generation or Voyager, perhaps the shows that were a miss for me, maybe when I watched them early on, I come back years later and I watch them again, and all of a sudden they mean something to me. It's kind of this hermeneutical sort of take on Star Trek. And I hear a lot of people talking about, well, Star Trek wasn't progressive enough, and you know, we're looking, you know, we're looking at it now, looking back and saying, oh, you know, well, Star Trek, the original series, wasn't progressive enough. And when really in its time, it was about as progressive as you get in late 1960s television. And so as we kind of move forward, I'm really hopeful that we can bring that kind of depth. And yeah, there even though the 13 episode series, there are going to be episodes, I'm sure, that are going to fall flat, they're going to miss. But I don't know. I think my hope for Discovery, probably more than anything, is that 20 years from now, you know, three fanboys can get together and have a conversation, a deep, you know, meta type conversation, and explore, you know, these philosophical issues, talking about, you know, the worldview, the philosophy, you know, where it hit, where it missed, and really have that kind of deep conversation. And Star Trek will continue to do what it's always done, and that's continually cause us to think and evaluate and reason, ask those deep questions, as Zachary talked about, and really sort of force us to explore our own existentialism.
Are you saying that 20 years from now on Metatrex episode 1000, we're going to do a 20-year retrospective on Discovery?
Yeah, yeah. We're going to bring Larry out of retirement, and yeah, absolutely.
Episode. Who says I'll be retired?
We'll have you back on Metatrex episode 1047, Larry.
1047. Well, that's what's fun to talk to anybody that worked on the shows, you know, like obviously not in the 60s, in the one airing and one rerun 60s. And that's where, you know, broadcast technology, that's where media technology was. But even like the last, you know, Enterprise, just to talk to writers and the crew people, it's like doing what you're doing, carrying around a little level in your brain or a little chip on your shoulder of going on top of everything else. You know that somebody 20 years, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years from now is going to be looking at what you're doing right now. It's been like, oh my God, you can't think that. You can't think that. You just have to do what you can do as a creator, as a designer in the moment,
yeah.
You know, as a technician in the moment. You can't worry about all that. And it's like you just hope that maybe Gene's DNA that you're still trying to hang on to, you know, will do that. But you know, you drive yourself psychotic if you carry the future burdens of whatever. And so, yeah, there's hits and misses, but I have no doubt that, and again, back to, you know, Brian not being in the driver's seat, but even in the back seat, mm-hmm. Even in the trunk, kind of muffledly like yelling out through the lid of the trunk, that the Discovery will be in the, I mean, I'm so excited to see, even as I know that there's all kinds of, you know, there's all kinds of dangers of throwing a proscenium stage on that Greek play. As we go along, that Brian at his core was a fanboy and knew his old, you know, back in the day, and that doesn't go away. And everybody brings their different take to that, you know. And it's funny how the things that they're always jarring at first. Oh my God, Wrath of Khan was jarring. Like, what's with these uniforms, you know? And what? She's a half Vulcan Romulan. What? What? Admiral on the Bridge, what the hell is that? Oh, it's the Reagan 80s. Oh, it's so militarized. you guys laugh. But, you know, it's like everything new. And then the more time goes by, the more things get smoothed down, the more we, you know, we retcon things in, or the more we find, you know, sometimes we just have our experience broadened and we go, oh, okay, well, that's not as jarring. But it's that first time. And there's going to be some of that happening. I just have to have all kinds of faith that team of good current writers and enough Trek DNA there with Joe and with Nick Meyer and Brian's, you know, original impetus, and Kirsten Byer, you know, her track record from her Voyager, awesome, way beyond Voyager novels, that there's good, that there's a lot of good DNA and a lot of good impetus there in the show. And then we will be talking about it 20 years from now.
And we will take whatever happens and incorporate it into our fandom. Like, we'll synthesize it together, and the universe, the in-universe universe will remain coherent. You know, we'll make it that way, so one way or the other.
But if every 8-year-old girl next year at Comic Cons all over the country is running around dressed like the lead character, that would just be awesome for once. It'd be like the final hurrah of Star Trek. Or not the final hurrah, but you know, take that pop culture, you know, revolution, Comic-Con era. Take that Marvel, DC, you know, MC. Not to be competitive about it, but it's just unfair that Star Trek was the template, wrote the book for this, and was just out there at its height, at its commercial height, before the current. You know, it set the stage for that. So it's the pioneer that doesn't get any respect now. So I don't say not no respect, but it's lost in the weight of all that's come. So it would be awesome to see that happen. Purely on a spectral surface commercial level, All this other will still be here for us to dissect, but I would still love to see that. Who knows?
Well, guys, this has been a fascinating discussion. Larry, you want to tell our listeners what's going on in your universe?
Well, this discussion we've had is exactly what's been interesting, kind of came out of necessity since we've been in the fallow time, but we're gearing up here. But that's one of the main reasons why, not quite as meta level as you guys do famously, but that's one of the reasons why by dot connecting and being around the franchise as long as I've been, as well as being a fan, is why I finally came up with Portal 47, which we've been talking about the last year, and it's growing. We just had our 1 year anniversary and had a big public open house. And it's amazing that Robert Butler, who directed The Cage, is still a going guy, and he's 88 and came on and we did an hour with him, as an open house kind of telebriefing. So, Portal 47, we deep dive with our deep divers and in several ways. I'm still evolving it, but I'm so proud to put something I think is kind of a new paradigm in fandom out there. So I encourage everybody to go over portal47.net if you've heard me talk about it. But we say, somebody said today you should say it's a new bridge to the bridge. But it's basically how we have a mini con all year long, no matter where your center seat might be. And I say it's for new fans, old fans, fans who have no idea how much they don't know yet about Star Trek. And it's been exciting to bring a lot of people and bring a lot of these topics out to our fan group, and we're growing. It's $25 a month. It's the cost of 2 movie tickets a month on several levels, live and online, but live most of the time, and face-to-face and online. And anyway, I just encourage everybody to go look at it. And you can go look at it via my whole new, by the time this hits up, I think we've turned the switch on my whole new look at my website, mylarrynemechek.com, where everything about The Con of Wrath, our documentary, it's finally wrapping up. And I post about that, and my Trekland on series CD, which is my remastered interviews over all the years, put out as a theme. And this year's, I barely even promoted it because I didn't have my store ready to go. We've been redoing the website, but I called it 30 on 50. So to celebrate the 50th, I went back to Tribulations and Flashback. We just had the 20th anniversary of Tribulations a couple of days ago.
Amazing.
Made everybody go back. And it dawned on me, here's talk about your new way of framing things. It was like, oh, it's like this was Tribulations the best fan film ever?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I just can't believe it was 20 years ago. But
Yeah, that's the thing. People are still staggered that was 20 years. Sorry to do the time math. But yeah, so my new site's got all those pages, and it actually looks like it's from this century and built by a professional web designer. So I'm really proud about that, and proud that I haven't got to talk about the new Trekland on Speaker CD this year. But I say CD, I know people download, but you can't autograph a download if you can't make it personal that way. So that's why I still do that before the downloads happen. So yeah, that's what's been going on. And I gave a shout out earlier to enterpriseinspace.org. I wish everybody would go over and be a virtual crew member for $20 and fly your name on a chip aboard the first Enterprise in space that's going to do so much, starting with in a global effort to get 100 winning projects from students from K through, we said preschool through postgrad. And now we've got about 15 aerospace companies in as partners and collaborators, from the Smithsonian Science Center through Made in Space, who do the 3D printers on the station. Just a lot of in-kind partners. So I encourage everybody to go over and read about that. There's some amazing things happening, about to break loose with that, and be part of that. Talk about inspiring future generations and what you can do from the comfort of your own living room, and follow along with that. So yeah, Enterprise in Space and the 50th anniversary here. I've got 2 cons left the rest of the year. A brand new convention called Northeast Trek Con in Albany here this next weekend. And I'm going to be at Starbase Indy the weekend after Thanksgiving, the Thanksgiving weekend, but not Thanksgiving Day, in Indianapolis. And a few things coming up already for next year. How do you top the 50th? Well, you have a new series on TV finally. So I'm excited for fandom next year in the convention scene.
Boy, Larry, you're not a very busy guy, are you?
Yeah, I just have to finish some of this stuff. Move ahead. But yeah, we try. It's been exciting. It's been a challenge to keep up with. It's like the world, and like we've been talking about here, the world is changing, and fandom and the ways you can, and I have some other ideas up my sleeve if we can ever get around and circle back around to do that. But Yeah, most of all, I'm really excited for Portal 47. It's just barely getting off the ground still, and I'm just excited when people that are in enjoy what we're doing so much, and some of the people we brought out, and some of the things we've done, and the way we've done it. So I'll just leave that out there. So at Larry Nemechek on Twitter, LarryNemechek.com on the web, Larry Nemechek's Trekland. Almost everything I do has a Facebook page, including the Trekland trunk, which if you love archival stuff, that's where I'm putting it out, hopefully in the non-sleazy way to sell it. And I think that's about done it. I think I kept my commercial fairly short there.
No, that was great. And of course, we're always very proud to promote Enterprise in Space here on Metatrex. We do week after week. We actually have here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area a chapter of the National Space Society. I've been able to make some connections there and have really taken an interest in that. So always glad to be a part of that. And of course, I've had the opportunity to sit on a couple of your Portal 47 telebriefings, and they're fantastic.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you for doing a shout-out for National Space Society, which is one of the two major citizen, you know, lobbying, private citizen support groups for space and space travel and industrializing space and getting us into the future in a practical way, as well as an idealistic, visionary way. And they're sponsoring Enterprise in Space. So thank you for.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we've been talking about all day here so far. I mean, you know, this is a participatory, engaging way to bring the future into fruition. And it's the best way to be involved.
Actually, excellent. Thanks.
Well, Larry, thank you very much for joining us on the Starship of Theseus.
Yes. It's been a wonderful trip. Now, just drop me off gently. Beam me down. I'm not quite as skittish as McCoy, but, you know, it's still a new thing here in 2016 to be beamed. So I appreciate the experience.
Well, come back and join us again. All right.
Okay.
We're glad to be joining us, Larry.
Transporter Chief, energize.
Well, Mike, it was great to finally have Larry on the show. You know, with episode 47, we couldn't pass up the chance to have him on. And we've been meaning to have Larry on for a long time. You know, very few people have the sort of insider insights into the production of Star Trek that Larry has. And it was a fascinating discussion about Star Trek fandom and where we'd like to see Star Trek go, the philosophy of the past 50 years of Star Trek, and how Star Trek can continue to be relevant into the future. And I just hope that we make an impact. I hope that people who are listening sincerely get some value out of the discussions we have. They learn something new, think about ideas they haven't thought of before. And I hope that, you know, if people are listening who have any influence on what Star Trek will become, that they continue to take the best of Star Trek, move us into the future, continue to explore the human condition and explore these philosophical ideas that we talk about on Metatrex, and ultimately make the world the kind of world we want to be. And if we play any part in that and all in these kinds of conversations, I feel like we've done a good job.
That was a lot of fun talking to Larry. His insights into Star Trek past, present, and even his prognostications about Star Trek future. I find him very fascinating. I think it's interesting. His intuitions, Zachary, are very much in line with, I think, what you and I share in terms of our intuitions about what Star Trek was, is, and will become. So it was fascinating to bring him in here. Episode 47, it was the perfect time to have Larry. I hope to be able to get him back. I still want to do our 47 parts of the Prime Directive episode. So hopefully we can get him back on Subspace sometime. But just a lot of fun. And at the end of the day, for me, I just have confidence. I have faith that the Star Trek universe will unfold as it's supposed to. And you know what Star Trek will become. I'm very confident that it will continue to push the envelope and tell stories that explore the human condition in science, you know, in a science fiction format that will cause us to look introspectively and really, I think, plot a course on how to get from here to there into that utopian future. I do have hope and confidence that the universe will unfold as it should, and never more so than I have right now after talking to Larry and kind of getting his insights. I think he shares that hope as well.
Well, listeners of the show, regular listeners of the show, will probably have noticed that we've had a lot of guests on the show recently, you know, almost episode by episode. We promise very soon we're going to get back to the usual, you know, Zach and Mike show episode by episode. But, you know, we wanted to take this chance in the 50th anniversary of Star Trek to bring some other voices onto the show. And I learned something from every single person we have on the show about what Star Trek means to them, the kinds of insights that they get, the vision that Star Trek gives them, the impact that Star Trek has made. I really enjoy hearing people's stories about those things, because one of the fundamental questions in this 50th anniversary of Star Trek is, what does Star Trek mean? What has it meant? What did it mean in the 60s? What did it mean for me? It was growing up in the 1980s and early 1990s. What does it mean for us here in the 21st century? And how can Star Trek help bring the future that we all enjoy seeing on the screen into reality in some meaningful way? And I think the other voices we brought onto the show have added a lot to what that could mean. So we promise we're going to get back to our usual run of just Zach and Mike talking about Star Trek and philosophy here before long, but we want to continue, you know, bringing people onto the show for the for the 50th anniversary of Star Trek to hear their stories, get their insights, and work that into what we're trying to do here on MetaTrek. So it's been a really interesting batch of discussions we've had over the last few episodes. I've really enjoyed it.
Without a doubt. And I will go ahead and say that episode 48, our upcoming episode, we will be returning to our Philosophy Essentials format. We are on the original series, season 3. Well, Zachary, it's been a lot of fun talking to Larry Nemechek about Star Trek Discovery and the future of Star Trek and philosophy, but this isn't the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look, everyone, at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm. To the journey!
Some races are like Talaxians. We really don't know how long they've kind of been around.
Char, what? I just had a great idea. I need to calm myself down. I need some
breathe,
ice. I need
breathe.
Some ice.
Oh, okay. Rest your head.
Okay.
Easy. In
All right.
And out.
Warp 5.
What's your favorite episode of Enterprise?
I usually say Strange New World. The first part of Strange New World just reminds me so much of being a kid and growing up in southeastern Oklahoma and the mountains and the woods. And I just imagine what it would be like to go camping on an alien planet.
Meta Treks.
After 150 years of sitting around in the mud, that's got to be one relaxed symbiont.
But there again, it shows that, at least for the symbiont on Trill, that there's life beyond the mud.
Life beyond the mud.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, no problem. We've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include things like early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And as Larry mentioned during our conversation, we want you to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we've discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our MetaTrek show page on the Trek FM website, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, our Twitter handle is @trekfm.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/TrekFM and find us in the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We'd also like to invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Zachary, when you're not practicing your fanboy voice, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not busy planning MetaTreks episode 1047... where can people find you around the Trek FM network and on the interwebs?
I'm always most active on Facebook. Certainly, you can catch me around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. We'd like to take a moment, Zachary, to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher, the very heart of our network here at Trek FM. Executive producers Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Ken Tripp. Our art director, Aaron Harvey. Production manager, Richard Marquez. We'd like to give a special shout-out to our two associate producers, Patrick Devlin. You can connect with Patrick on Twitter at MagicDrop5. And Kay Elizabeth Janeway. You can connect with her on Twitter at Choco Weeble. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.